Good morning. It's 9 o'clock on Friday, April 22nd, Earth Day. Before I make any meeting comments, I'm going to turn it over to our Spanish interpretation, Aldo.
Thank you so much. Good morning. I will provide instructions in Spanish for our Spanish-speaking community. Muy buenos días a todos ustedes. Bienvenidos a la reunión a la Junta del Agua. Esta reunión se llevará a cabo en inglés. Sin embargo, vamos a proporcionar servicios de interpretación. Para activarlos, si es tan amable, favor de ir a la pantalla inferior, de la parte de inferior de su pantalla, y una vez que lo haga, verá un icono en forma de un mundo. Favor de presionar el icono y aparecerá inglés y español. Seleccionar español. Si tiene algún problema o dificultad, favor de comunicarse con nosotros y lo apoyaremos para que tenga éxito con esta reunión. Muchísimas gracias y que tenga buena reunión. Thank you so much, Jerry. May continue.
Thank you so much, Aldo. Good morning, everyone. Again, thank you for joining us this Friday. Today is Earth Day. We welcome you to our April 22nd hybrid meeting. This includes both a physical meeting location and an option for online remote participation through the Zoom webinar platform. Today, we will be receiving presentations and public comment through in-person and online remote participation. The Zoom meeting link has been made available along with the public speaker online request form via our agenda website meeting participation page. For those who would like to watch and listen to the meeting, the Water Board's customary webcast is also available. If you are a remote presenter or public speaker, you should already be in the Zoom webinar as an attendee using the meeting link provided on the board's website and should have submitted a speaker online request form. Requests to provide public comment for individual items on the agenda will be accepted up to the start of each item. For those of you who are with us in person, requests are able to be submitted using a blue comment card at the back of our room. Alternatively, you can scan the online request QR code posted in the room and fill out the online form. If you are having trouble with the remote link, online speaker request form, or webcast, please contact the clerk 3-commentletter@waterboards.gov. Presenters and speakers will be on mute with cameras off until it's your turn to speak. The meeting host will then unmute you and ask you to turn your camera on if you have one and would like to. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed again on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom webinar until the completion of your item, and you may choose to exit the webinar, continue via Zoom, or follow the webcast. Again, this meeting is being webcast and recorded. Portions of it are also being translated into Spanish. So please speak slowly and clearly. Items 11 and 12 are being translated into Spanish, and the Zoom channel is being streamed in our office lobby. I would also like to notify you that due to a COVID exposure at the Central Coast Water Board offices this week, our executive officer, Mr. Keeling, assistant executive officer, Ms. Tryon, and our vice chair, Dr. Wolf, are in the building but joining remotely. I'd like to take a few moments to acknowledge that today is Earth Day. Certainly the foundations of which are rooted in our Central Coast region, specifically in Summerland, which is in Santa Barbara County. First developed in 1896, promise I won't go through a long, exhaustive history, the Summerland oil field was the first offshore oil well in the United States. Following decades of oil extraction, Union Well was drilling new wells along the Summerland coastline on the morning of January 28, 1969. When drillers reached their final depth of 3,475 feet, only 239 of which had been fitted with a steel conductor casing, the drill pulled out and an enormous amount of uncontained pressure caused Platform A, 5 miles off the coast in the channel, to blow out, rupturing the ocean floor and belching out oil and gas. Within 14 minutes of the blowout, oil was on the surface of the ocean and spreading. Over a 14-day period, up to 1,000 barrels of crude oil fouled the water, decimating wildlife from Ventura to Goleta and impacting wider areas to the Mexico border and up to Pismo Beach. It was at that time the largest spill in the United States and remains the third largest in the United States after the Deepwater Horizon in 2010 and the Exxon Valdez in 1989. The Summerlin, the oil catastrophe in 1969 received wide media coverage, galvanizing an already wide and burgeoning environmental movement. This modern environmental movement was born in 1962 and emerged out of a three-part series published in the New Yorker. Silent Spring, authored by Rachel Carson, brought attention to the indiscriminate use of pesticides. She chronicled DDT poisoning of people, animals, insects in American communities, illustrating how deep, how deep our disconnection and alienation from the interconnected web of life was threatening our very existence. She suggested that liberal democracies need to change the method of operation and encouraged people to question governance, ask fundamental questions about power dynamics, and required people to ponder whose voices were being heard and to examine why only certain voices prevailed in our dialogue. She also encouraged a generation to be critical and become active in fomenting a movement. Hence, when Platform A blew out, the nascent environmental community blew up. Senator Gaylord Nelson, a junior senator from Wisconsin, spurred into action. He, along with Congressmember Pete McCloskey and an activist, Dennis Hayes, began with the idea of organizing student teach-ins on college campuses nationwide to discuss environmental degradation. They chose April 22, 1970. This was a weekday, and it was right between spring break and final exams. As momentum increased through their organizing, they chose to rename the day Earth Day. This day united 20 million Americans, at the time 10% of the population, to take to the streets to demonstrate against the deleterious impacts of hundreds of years of environmental degradation. The national outcry and outrage led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. Contemporaneously, around noon, on June 22, 1969, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio, a fire was sparked from a passing train. The train sparked oil-slicked debris floating in the river, causing a massive fire to burn. Shockingly, however, according to accounts at the time, the 1969 fire didn't surprise the locals. In fact, the river had burned 10 times over the previous century, and the local newspaper coverage focused on the damage, not on the river itself. People largely saw the river as part of the industrial infrastructure instead of a life-giving force. However, within the context of the relatively recent oil spill in Summerlin, an emerging national awareness and intolerance of pollution, the Cuyahoga River became emblematic of rampant and extensive pollution of water. Although the National Water Pollution Control Act had been passed in 1965, it was largely ineffectual. So the two events in 1969 captured the attention of the populace to further invigorate and foment the first Earth Day, the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency, and the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972. Happy 50th birthday to the Clean Water Act. If you've been listening just a little bit to this extremely abbreviated story of the past 52 years in this very particular place in the world, you notice that unless there are fires, devastations, calamity, it seems as a species we're hard-pressed to act. Is that so? I say no. I say, despite the existential threat of climate change and disaster, the contemporaneous wars raging through our people and our ecosystems, historic pandemic, racial divide and equity, which we discussed yesterday, potential political intractability, I stand on the side of hope. Not an aspirational hope, a hope born out of the need to hope because the present is unbearable, but a hope that recognizes that illusion of separation. Hope that knows that when we come together, we can accomplish things. Ubuntu, meaning the concept of relational identity, we are shaped by our relations. I am because you are. I am because we are. I am because the stars are, the river is, the ocean is, the earth is. As we gather here today on sacred grounds, in this sacred space, in this sacred moment, we honor the generations of many people who have brought us here, many messengers, human, animal, plant, mineral, who've delivered their tender and fierce missives, reminding us of shared responsibility to stand in relationship with our Earth. Let's celebrate Earth Day. Celebrate the Clean Water Act. Be mindful, have reverence for our plants and our animals, rededicate to healthy and regenerative relationships and our fellow beings. Every day is Earth Day. Thank you. Okay. So
can I say something also?
Oh, absolutely.
Just as a follow-up to that, I wanted to say that one of the most interesting things that I got to do as an elected official was to go on a trip to Platform Irene. They took a lot of local elected officials to show them how safe it was and how wonderful it was. But one of the first things that they showed us was, if you hear this siren, run to one of the either sides and jump in the submarine and put your seatbelts on and all of that, because then the submarine will drop in the water and sail away from any explosion on it. But it was very interesting, and I'm really glad that I got the chance to do that. And I also got to, on another field trip in Arizona, we visited the nuclear plant there. And that was also very interesting. So times have changed. We have so many wonderful laws now. We just have to enforce them. And we have so many good people working on all these things now. And it's a lot of good news, a lot of bad news in the world, but we have a lot of good things to celebrate.
Appreciate that. I second that. Any other comments? Okay. So again, we will turn back to our agenda. We will go to roll call. Ms. Olson?
Thank you. Chair Gray?
Present.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Present.
Member Hunter?
Present.
Member Harlan?
Here.
Thank you.
Great. I'm going to turn it over to our executive officer now for introductions, recognitions, and awards.
Thank you, Chair Gray. And also thank you for your opening remarks regarding Earth Day. It's good. Good context regarding why we're all here today, particularly as it relates to the advent of the Clean Water Act. All I'd like to add is just an acknowledgement of our dedicated staff and all the work that they do every day that is really integral to environmental protection. You know, the world is changing around us every day, some ways good and some ways not so good. And one of the things that we're committed to is adapting to those changes, and as we discussed yesterday, to seize the moment. So one of the things that we're doing on an ongoing basis is trying to imbue our culture and the lens through which we view our work to make sure that it includes consideration of a number of issues that are particularly relevant, not the least of which would be the conversation we had yesterday about racial equity and environmental justice. Also, particularly as it relates to climate change and climate justice. So what we're doing in working with our staff and with this board is to make sure that when we are considering the work that we're doing and the actions that we're taking, we're looking at that work through different lenses, that making sure that we're clearly understanding, acknowledging, and addressing some very, very salient issues that are ongoing with us. So I just wanted to again acknowledge and thank our staff and our board for their ongoing commitment and dedication to moving the needle in the direction where, hopefully we can help facilitate, if not implement, direct change as it relates to racial equity, environmental justice, climate justice, and climate change adaptation. So with that, I will go into my normal introductions, and I'll start with Ms. Tammy Olson, our clerk to the board.
Good morning.
Morning, Tammy. With us today from our Office of Chief Counsel, we have Ms. Stephanie Yu.
Good morning.
Good morning, Stephanie. And our Assistant Executive Officer, Ms. Taya Tryon. Introduce her as the Executive Officer like I did yesterday.
Thank you.
From our Section Manager team today, we have Angela Schroeder.
Good morning.
Good morning, Angela. And Mary Hamilton.
Good morning.
Good morning. And as I did yesterday, I'd also like to acknowledge and thank our audio video team and waterboard staff, IT support. So thanks for AGP Video for helping us run our hybrid meeting today and streaming our meeting on CalSpan. And I'd also like to thank our staff, Aaron Katona, as well as our State Water Board Division of Information Technology, Bob Chow, who's been helping us kind of on the back end to make sure our meeting runs smoothly. And then today I'd also like to introduce our State Water Board liaison, Sean McGuire, who, after we get rid of some of our normal administrative business, is going to give us a State Water Board statewide update. And I believe he's with us this morning. I haven't checked yet. Maybe he hasn't logged in.
I am here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. And then I'll turn it over to Jennifer Epp, who has one staff-related announcement for us this morning before we move on to the next item.
Good morning. My life. There we go. Good morning. Jennifer Epp. I'm the Waste Discharge Requirements Program Manager here at the Water Board, and I'm here to introduce one of our student assistants who's new. Her name is Corinne Watson. She's going to be helping out both the NPDS group as well as the WDR group. And Corinne is a sophomore at Cal Poly, and she's in the Environmental Engineering major. Corinne comes to us from Colorado prior to coming to Cal Poly. And a fun fact about Corinne is that she has recently submitted a research paper for peer review. So she's looking to get published as a sophomore, which is a fairly unique and really cool thing that she is doing. So sometime ask her about her research and we can see if we can understand it or not. But welcome, Corinne.
Thanks for joining us. Welcome, Corinne. Nice to see you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. I'm very excited. So.
I think, yeah. Why don't you come back?
Yeah, I always have something I can that comes to mind. And I just want to thank you for taking on a role and exploring your field and coming into this group, into this agency. I know that your experience and what you will learn about and be exposed to, not COVID, sorry, that it will make a huge difference in how you see yourself and how you explore your career options. And you're working with a highly professional organization. Every one of our staff just has the highest standards. So you couldn't have put yourself through a more demanding and more, I think, compelling experience. So good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Vice Chair Wolf, you are on mute.
First, I unmute myself, but being remotely located here, I wanted to also express to you a warm welcome and I look forward to one of our next meeting when I can do this face-to-face with you and actually shake your hand and congratulate you on having made what I think is a great choice for your career. So thank you.
Thank you.
Stephanie, anything? Okay, thank you very much. We're very happy that you're joining us. Mr. Keeling, anything else from you?
That concludes our introductions and announcements this morning. Thank you.
Great. Okay, the next item on our agenda is our public forum. Ms. Olson, do we have any public comment?
Just a moment. No, we do not.
Okay, thank you. The next item on our agenda is approval of the board meeting minutes. These are the meeting minutes from February 17th and 18th.
I will move to approve.
I believe Ms. Harlan has some comments.
Second, and I have just two little corrections. On the minutes, I voted yes to approve the minutes, but then I was advised, since I hadn't attended the meeting, that it would be better for me to abstain, even though I know you can, if you know they're correct or think they're correct, you can vote on the issue, but I did change it to abstain. And then Ms. Steingruner doesn't live in Capitola, she lives in Aptos. So just wanted to make those two changes, please.
So I will move to approve with those changes.
Okay, may I have a second?
Second.
Okay. Can we get a roll call vote, please?
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Aye.
Member Harlan?
Aye.
Member Hunter?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is reports by our regional board members. Ms. Harlan, do you have anything to report?
No.
Okay. Ms. Hunter, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Yes, I attended a briefing with Angela Schroeder and Matt Keeling on the 18th of April regarding the review of environmental justice and racial equity panel. And on the 19th, I attend staff briefing for this board meeting. And if I could just take a moment, I did, on reflection, have a comment about Earth Day and my own awareness. And it has to do with this being in this place. When I was finishing my preparation as an anthropologist working on environmental issues, the thing that was most compelling to me, and in fact, it was through the staff, I was starting to get engaged with professionals working in environmental management, resource management. And the thing that struck me the most was, it was mid-90s to early 2000s, the struggle that the environmental scientists across all stripes were going through in considering a tremendous effort to rearrange from a jurisdictional artificial boundaries of agencies and their authorities, counties, cities, that had sections of rivers or watersheds being split up through these jurisdictional boundaries. And it was the environmental scientists that really had to put their heads together across agencies and begin to reimagine ecosystem health, ecosystem functioning. And it was a paradigm change. And as an anthropologist, I was engaged with folks really rethinking what they knew and how they were going to go about their work and approach their mission, their passion. And it was very compelling. And I see in the room today, Mr. Gary Ruggioni, who was one of the folks involved with the estuary, National Estuary Program here at Morro Bay. And that particular group, that watershed management process, planning process, and becoming the last national estuary, the 28th to qualify for the program, which was a tremendous effort. That group was made up of nearly 60 people, and I interviewed most of them. I think I interviewed over half and talked to them about their experience with that. But it was stakeholders, it was agency folks, it was landowners, public and private. And then on a regional scale, we had the federal agencies involved as well. And it was a very remarkable process. It was a dialogue that took, I think, more than 4 years. It was very grassroots oriented. And in fact, the folks here in Morro Bay established the first state estuary. They went to Sacramento and fought for it. There were about four people that went to Sacramento and insisted that we had to have a state estuary in order to qualify to establish national estuary status. This estuary is very small, the watershed is very small, but the estuary itself is very crucial to the flood. But in the end, they prevailed. And I recall that one of them, I want to say his name was Bill Nelson, told me that he promised the legislator that they were working with, they would never ask for money. They just wanted the designation. And that's how they got it. And that's why the National Estuary here exists now and is funded annually by our estuary, National Estuary Program. And we are very fortunate to have that. So I was part of that process. It established my career and in terms of my thinking and my goals and the imperative that I felt to be part of a transition in the way we think about the world around us. So I want to thank you, Chair Gray, for your comments this morning. And I hadn't contemplated that for a very long time. So thank you for helping me to kind of reflect on my own roots in this matter. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I have just an announcement that I thought everyone would just be interested in hearing about. There's going to be a conference tomorrow that unfortunately I'm going to miss, but it's called World Class Science and Community Climate Action. Learn about the science happening to understand the impacts of climate change on the oceans and our local coastal climate. Connect with local community organizations working to prepare our community for life in a changing climate. Nonprofits, public officials, and businesses that are sponsoring this are California National Marine Sanctuary Foundation, City of Santa Cruz, Coastal Watershed Council, County of Santa Cruz, Ecology Action, Elders Climate Action, Land Trust, Santa Cruz County, O'Neill Sea Odyssey, the Resource Conservation District, Santa Cruz Climate Action Network, Santa Cruz Mountains Trail Stewardship, Santa Cruz Museum of Natural History, Save Our Shores, Save the Waves, Sea Otter Savvy, the Sierra Club, and the Ventana Wilderness Alliance. So that's a large group of people. The University of California, Santa Cruz, science and research booths that will be there. Some of them are Long Marine Lab, Paleogenomics Lab, Conservation Science and Solutions Lab, the CETO Lab, the Galena Hale, Norris Center for Natural History, Coastal Science and Policy, Año Nuevo Reserve, and Younger Lagoon Reserve. There are a number of student groups that will be there also. The Sea Slugs at UC Santa Cruz and Student Housing Coalition and Women in Science and Engineering up at the university. And music and food and other sponsors, but it sounds like a wonderful day to learn about it, for people to come together. And it's very exciting. I'm glad that we're having that.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments, Dr. Hunter. Okay, other items? Vice Chair, do you have reports?
Yes, I do. And first, because I'm a bit of a disadvantage here, my little cubbyhole, how many people do we have in the room? Because I can't see it from
here. We have three people sitting in the audience. go ahead and let us know who you are if you'd like to, since you can't
Chair
see
Gray, if I, yeah. There we go. That's what okay. I was going to ask for.
Thank you. We also have a staff member. Them. You can't hear them. The Nat Bay Foundation. Go ahead. Two members of the Bay Foundation are here in our audience. Yeah.
Well,
we also have a staff member.
Julia. Does.
Julia is also right. In the back. and then the rest of us. I'm sorry. No, it's a little awkward. Very sorry.
I appreciate being also a people person in. You know, there is a value, from the dais to be able to make contact with people who make the time, carve out time of their day to come to recognize my appreciation for those of you who are here in the audience. So in terms of my report, and I will weave a little bit of, I guess I'll call it the positive relating to Earth Day as a board member, Stephanie Harland talked about some of the positive things going on. So in March, on March 7th, the Agriculture Liaison Advisory Board of the County of San Luis Obispo had its meeting at Farm Bureau. And the primary conversation was relating to two basins, the Paso Robles Basin, which is a critical basin, DWR, Department of Water Resource designated, and the city of San Luis Obispo, Etna Valley Basin, which is a high priority basin. And the conversations augmentation through recycled water and also some of the technologies. So it was a very, I would say, positive meeting because it's a difficult topic, particularly when looking at, curtailments of water use, etc. Then on the 11th of March, I hosted a tour for Cuesta College students with an emphasis, and this was organized by Cuesta College, and the emphasis was on water use, water conservation, water quality as it relates to irrigation, and the aspects of integrated pest management where, in some of the earlier comments made, which were some of a trigger for Earth Day related to pest pesticide application and transitioning to integrated pest management is a way to reduce the dependency and in some instance codependency on pesticides, but particularly harsh pesticide. And I always have to watch myself when I say pesticide because even using canola oil and soap as a surfactant, legally speaking, by definition is a pesticide. Anytime you kill a living organism, it's a pesticide by definition. Then same day, I attended a meeting with Chair Gray and our executive officer and staff relating to looking at, some various aspects of the PG&E settlement, which will be an item of discussion coming shortly. Then on March 25th, participated at conversation with the California Department of Food and Agriculture and the Resource Conservation Districts on a current program, which is encouraging water conservations through grants in irrigated agriculture. But what is interesting is the additional nexus associated with reduction of carbon emission. And one of the things that we tend to forget and sometimes actually ignore is, you know, when you turn your faucet on at home and you get about 35-40 PSI of water pressure, to get to that, it takes a significant amount of electrical energy to do it. And in fact, there are some statistics that if we take the state of California, in some instance, 80% of the energy use is moving around water. And if we take the water from the Sierra Nevada and bring it all the way to San Diego and Los Angeles, although part of it is gravity flowed in the open canal, it takes a significant amount of energy. And same thing. So by becoming more efficient in our irrigation and also improving our conservation, we also make a significant impact on reducing carbon emission. And that is why, for the first time, at least as I can recall in my years on the board, there is a very close nexus that has been built between California Department of Food and Agriculture and the State Air Resource Board. As it relates to improving our air quality through water conservation. So I found that to be very interesting. And this is also a point why today's an age, recycling water and water treatment facilities is absolutely paramount. It is irresponsible to treat water, which takes a lot of energy and carbon sequestration into this treated water, and still discharge it without putting it to beneficial use. Above and beyond discharge, you know, for aquatic life benefits. So moving on to my next step. I'm hosted for UC Cooperative Extension, a tour with demonstrations of research weather station, which more accurately measure on a real-time basis different key parameters to establish evapotranspiration, for example, to improve the integrated pest management, to reduce pesticide use. And these tours are organized by UC Cooperative Extensions through the Farm Advisors. And then on the same day of March the 29th, I attended a airport, which is just minutes from where this regional board location is. And all of the green waste of the county, at least the North County and a little bit of South County, is being taken to that facility, and also kitchen waste, you know, from the restaurants. And this mix of a green waste and kitchen waste is then put into biodigesters to produce electricity. But the byproduct is compost, and then tons of compost. And this facility just this year became approved and certified as an organic certification program for their compost, which will be so that was very interesting. And again, I think these are some of the good news of hopes, where we're taking waste, we're diverting it from landfills, and we actually have a win-win of generating electricity, and then also generating compost, which, as we know, part of our Agriculture Order 4.0, we're increasingly putting an emphasis on compost. And it's also working hand in hand with the Healthy Soil Initiative. Then the following month, this month of April on the 4th, attended with our executive officer, myself, a meeting at Supervisor Don Ortiz's office at the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisor location, a meeting to promote collaboration with some of the local entities to have a sewering connection system in some location and getting rid of on-site water treatment systems, particularly in flood zones. And then also to have a consolidation of some of the small water treatment facilities and, you know, looking at some of the upcoming opportunities of funding coming from the state of California. And then lastly, this month on the 7th, I also hosted for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce a tour on sustainability. And the city has actually identified Vienna Valley as a green belt zone many years ago. And this was a way to demonstrate some of the sustainability projects taking place on ag land in this area. So that concludes my input, but I thought, I reflected on this. I'm like, well, this is appropriate to emphasize a little bit some of the good things going on, particularly when we look at Earth Day. And again, like yesterday I was saying, I always look at the glasses three quarter full. I'm a bit of an optimist by nature, but it also points out to all the good things that this board is doing, the staff and the great people that we're bringing on. So I'm going to conclude this by saying that I think that the future is bright, and I want to thank everyone for listening to my summary of meetings.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wolf. I think the glass is always full. If it's not with liquid, it's with air. So for me, it's always full. So I'll give an abbreviated overview. Since March 4th, I've been meeting with our EO on a weekly basis. I've been meeting monthly with state board chairs the first Monday of every month, beginning in March, so March and April. I also met with our EO and Dr. Wolf on March 11th to discuss the PG&E funding. We had a subcommittee meeting. Let's see, what else? I spoke with Ms. Angela Schroeder on the 15th, last Friday, related to the environmental justice and racial equity item. And I spoke with Ms. Sarah Lopez on Tuesday, which was what day? The 19th of this month. That's my update. Okay. So at this time, and without further ado, I will thank our board liaison, Mr. Sean McGuire, for being extremely patient, and invite him to join us today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Chair Gray. And the thing about Zoom is you don't know how patient or impatient I'm being with the camera off, but that's okay. I really do enjoy hearing your updates, and happy Earth Day to you all. And, you know, what a great reminder and opportunity to reflect on how far we've come in really protecting our watersheds and our ocean waters. And, you know, like you, I'm, you know, yes, glasses half full. It's great to be in California, where we are environmental stewards and leaders worldwide, and we've accomplished so much. But, you know, I guess whether the rest of the glass is filled with air or nothing, I always do look at the work that we have ahead and the challenges that we face now, you know, whether it's climate change or the racial equity issues that we're all facing. And so, I with that in mind, you know, I have an update for you today. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I put together a couple of weeks ago is I give a number of regional board updates, and it's actually a little outdated already, but I want to share it with you anyway and just give you a sense for where we are here in the drought and how we are rising to the occasion to meet the challenges that we're facing. And I think that's an important checkpoint as well. So let's see, Mr. Keeling, should I share the presentation here?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And if our meeting host can allow Mr. McGuire the ability to do that, please do so now.
Everybody has ability to share.
Okay. I'm. Are you? Let's see. It's funny that I never do this actually anymore.
You might. Yeah. There you go. Presentation mode. That's great. Thank you.
Now? Okay.
Yes.
All right, great. So today I just wanted to update you all on the governor's executive order as it relates to the drought that he issued a few weeks ago. I talked briefly about a little bit of context for why, why we're in a drought and specifically looking at the Bay Delta watershed. I know we're not all connected to it, but it is critical to our ecosystem, to our water supply statewide, broadly. And so I think it's important to just keep you up to date on what's going on there. Briefly, a little bit about drinking water and some of the challenges and what we're doing about it there, and a couple of other items, mostly funding and a couple of other actions that we have underway right now. And I'm always open to questions. So, I don't think, for those of you who pay attention to the news, I don't think this will come as any surprise. January through March was our driest 3-month period on record. And, despite the October fantastic storm event that we had then, and, frankly, a very good December in terms of snowpack, things certainly took a dramatic turn for the dry. And here we are. This shows just sort of the precipitation differential and how most of the state here, the central part, was in the record driest. Of course, now in the last couple of weeks, we have been getting some precipitation here. I'm actually up in Wairika right now. I'm going to be going on some tours up in the Shasta River watershed today, where we've had a number of drought actions up in this area. And it was actually raining quite hard as I was driving up last night. But frankly, it's all welcome precipitation, but really not enough to make a difference in terms of our water year ultimately and some of the challenges that we're facing. And I'll explain why here shortly. So the executive order, which kind of came out of this recognition that the skies dried up, our snowpack dwindled, and really, if we don't take decisive action, we will have a number of watersheds and communities that are really facing fairly unprecedented challenges here, even in some cases potentially worse than the most recent drought in 2014. And so the executive order, if you haven't seen it, really just calls on all Californians to just strive to limit summertime use. And I think by that, it's really speaking to outdoor use, knowing that that's really the area that we have the most control over. We all need to use water indoors for various reasons. But really, the biggest component of urban water use is outdoors in most communities. And so to the extent we can all control that, please do your part as well. And as an approach for that, the governor asked for the state board for us by May 25th, which is about a month from now, to consider emergency regulations that look for the first time at defining and banning irrigation over the course of the drought on non-functional commercial, industrial, and institutional turf grass, which is a big change. And also looking at directing all urban water suppliers to move to at least a stage two of their water shortage contingency plans and accelerate submittal of a annual water supply and demand assessment to June 1st instead of July 1st, which was the date that was initially assigned for previous legislation. And a whole host of other actions, including looking at increasing coordination between local agencies and groundwater sustainability agencies when it comes to actions about deciding approval or disapproval of drilling new wells, particularly agricultural wells, and ensuring those wells are consistent with groundwater sustainability plans, improving outreach to communities, and also, of course, at the same time, trying to help streamline and accelerate critical recharge projects as we look forward to the future and hopefully a wet winter in this coming year. So, you know, for us, we actually had a workshop yesterday afternoon on those regulations that are directed for the State Board to consider. So I think there was a good discussion. I think there were about 500 attendees that I saw on our platform. So definitely a lot of interest in what we're looking at in terms of the non-functional turf considerations and also the water shortage contingency plan modifications. So more to come on that. And if you have questions, I'm happy to help answer those. This just shows kind of where we're at in terms of our water year. This, like I said, is a couple weeks old now. I think it was looking back to April 1st. But this, I get this update at every board meeting I have every 2 weeks. And so I just, you know, I wanted to share some of these slides with you so you can kind of see what I'm seeing in terms of our water supply. This is for the Sacramento, North Sacramento watershed. And it shows the blue line there in the middle, the shaded area. Hopefully you can see clearly enough on the screen is kind of our average. And the blue line is it's ticked up a little bit from there just given the recent rain, but it's still well within the average shaded area. And because we're actually in our third dry year in a row, and this has been a critically dry year, and what's happened is our reservoir storage and snowpack, which is shown here, and our reservoir storage has depleted significantly. DWR had recognized that it was going to take something on the order of a 150%, so a very wet year, frankly, in order to replenish our water supply from a deficit that we've accrued over the past couple of years. And so, you know, DWR goes out on April 1st. It's a critical day for the snow survey. And this is what they found. There's some pictures and videos of Carla Nemeth, the director for DWR, walking out. And I think they did find an area with about an inch of snow water content. And but as you can see here, most of the area is the snow had already melted on April 1st, which is typically when we see the highest level of snowpack for the year. Now, again, there has been some snow recently, but it's really not going to make a huge difference because the main reservoirs that we rely on, if you look in the top left here, you see Shasta at 38% of historical average, 48% of historical average and 38% of capacity. And then Oroville, which is the other critical reservoir at 47% of capacity, doing a little bit better. Are quite low, and these are not, this is not where we want to be in April. We want to be substantially higher than that because we rely on these reservoirs to meet our water supply needs for the rest of the year. So over the summer months and the fall, and then also just not knowing what the next year brings. So last year, Shasta at this time was over 2 million acre feet, which is still actually rather low, but here we are. It's even a lower level this year. And so there have been a number of actions, which I don't have time to get into today, regarding management of these reservoirs and allocation decisions in these watersheds to help preserve storage and balance ecosystem needs with water supply beneficial uses throughout the state here in the coming year. So basically, we don't have enough water in surface storage. We're trying to work with what we have, and it's teed us up for a really challenging time. So in the Delta, you know, we have emergency water right curtailment actions, regulations that we passed last year. We're in the process right now of considering updating those regulations. They have to be readopted once a year and making some tweaks to those. And the last couple of bullets here, we issued a temporary urgency change order to allow the projects to modify how they're operating and meeting water quality requirements in the Delta to help conserve storage, and also looking at ways to best manage that reservoir storage in its cold water pool in Shasta to help protect the fisheries. And as you probably know, some monids are incredibly sensitive to temperature. And last year we had very low survival of many of our salmon runs, and are trying to do everything we can this year to help protect and preserve the salmon runs this year. But again, it's going to be a huge challenge. That aside, just shifting from sort of our surface water supply balancing, we're also paying a lot of attention to our water systems. And our Division of Drinking Water spends a lot of time thinking about how best to communicate with our 7,000 plus water systems in the state of California, make sure that we're giving the information that we need to help make informed decisions, to pre-position resources, help communities if they do, for example, have a single source of supply and run out of water and need bottled water or hauled water to be brought in. And we've come a long way, I would say, in the last year or two in terms of the type of information that we collect, the way we monitor and provide assistance to these communities. And so this just shows a map of all the water systems in the state that are on some level of drought warning. The watch is sort of the least concerning level. The warning is a little bit higher. And then the drought emergency, there's 9 systems there that currently are receiving bottled water or hauled water because they've run out of supply. So you can see the systems there, and they really are spread throughout the state. So that does, because the state is experiencing a drought statewide, and so that presents a challenge, and we're certainly going to be watching this closely over the coming year. And the summer months where we typically see the biggest challenges. This just shows a new data collection system that is being used to help assess that information more quickly, so we can turn around assistance in a more efficient manner. And we do have, so the silver lining on all this, I guess, is that we do have funding. We have a number of programs underway with different providers to help, and are ready to help on call with communities around the state. We also work closely with DWR. They provide quite a bit of assistance as well. So this is really a fortunate situation that we're in to have access to these funds. And so I just want to emphasize that if you, through your work at the regional board, find any communities that need assistance, don't hesitate to reach out. We are here and want to help as much as we can. And part of our way to do that, I'm sure you work quite a bit with domestic well owners and individuals with very small water systems that have unique challenges. And so we are standing up a county-based assistance program as well. And so that that program is just getting started now, and we're working with a number of counties around the state, and I think are open to others joining. So it's just good, I think, in light of the challenges that we're facing, that there's going to be a number of different avenues for different community members to receive support. So on the funding side, we actually, at our board meeting this week, had a few discussions on funding, and it's interesting because at this point there are so many different buckets of funding. If you look at our existing state revolving funding programs, bonds from prior propositions that have are carrying over that still have funding available, the legislature's and governor's recent actions in terms of drought response and making significant funding available in last year's budget and also this year's budget potentially. The Federal Infrastructure Act from last year and those funds that actually haven't even, are just now starting to come available to the state. So we have certainly significant challenges, but also opportunities to leverage many, many billions of dollars of funding that's geared towards climate action and drought and water resilience, and also addressing many water quality challenges. And so I've talked with you about this before. I think you've heard updates, but I just wanted to let you know that we did adopt our intended use plan update to allocate the $1.3 billion in water and wastewater infrastructure funding that was made available through last year's budget. And so it's about a 50-50 split, somewhere around $600+ million for each of those programs. And the drinking water funding is geared priority to disadvantaged communities, and the wastewater funding, about half of that $600 million is prioritized for septic to sewer projects, which I know is a big priority in your region. And so that funding is available, and as we've talked about before, has a fairly short application timeline. I believe the applications are due in November, so that will be coming up very quickly. So hopefully you'll be able to work with some of your communities to get an application in if they're in a position to do so. And there's more funding coming. We had a workshop on Wednesday on about $400 million in recycled water and groundwater cleanup funding, and those program criteria that is available now. So we'll be looking at adopting that program here in the coming months. There's more funding available, some federal funding. And like I said, through the federal act, there's approximately another $6 billion coming over the course of 5 years to that program as well. So we're going to be looking at further amendments to our intended use plan in the next few months and deciding how best to allocate those funds. So it's really a lot just on the funding topic to keep up with that opportunity. And we really want to make sure that we're getting the word out to folks so that they can start preparing and thinking about their projects, getting them in the queue so that we can do our best to help fund those with the highest level of need. And so I just wanted to flag for you that there are every year, I believe twice a year, actually, we have virtual, we have funding fairs that used to be in person around the state. Currently, they're virtual. Maybe they will continue to be so if that's working well. But there are two that are scheduled, one on May 17th, coming up here next month, and May 25th. And so the link is right there below those dates. So I encourage you to share that. The state board will be an active presence. I think we have the most funding for water projects of any state agency, but other state and federal agency partners participate in those funding fairs as well. And there's a number of other funding opportunities. And just a couple of quick notes here on a few other bullets. This could be a I could have several slides here with other ongoing board processes, so I don't want to underplay the importance of everything that we have going on here, but I just wanted to highlight for you a couple of items that came to mind. I know yesterday you had your discussion on racial equity and environmental justice, and I really regret not being able to attend, and but I'm glad that these meetings are recorded, and I will be watching the recording. And certainly look forward to joining you for discussions when you have them in the future, and hopefully in person. Hopefully I'll be there with you and be able to have those face-to-face dialogues, because I think it is so critical to our work here at the boards generally. And you know that we adopted our racial equity resolution at the state board last fall, and have been hard at work in working on now the racial equity action plan, which is in development. We've hired a consultant team to help work with our staff to help develop that and implement a public process and an internal process with a number of workshops and engagements over the next few months here, with the intent to have the action plan completed later this year. So they have a huge workload they're undertaking to have that completed. And hopefully you will be engaged as well in that process and have opportunities to contribute. It's not to take away anything from what you decide to do at the Central Coast region. That is your decision completely. But just looking at the water boards generally and our work at the state board and how we can all work together to achieve our common goals of racial equity, hopefully you'll have an opportunity to participate in our action plan development, because it will, as I see it from the state board perspective, help steer our decision making, how we look at projects and policy making for the foreseeable future in addressing racial equity and environmental justice concerns statewide. We also, our Division of Drinking Water released an administrative draft hexavalent chromium maximum contaminant level for drinking water. And so that was a long time coming. I might recall it was previously adopted by Department of Public Health, I believe back in 2017 or around that time, was subsequently overturned by a court due to specific issues. And so our team has been hard at work. This has been a big priority for us to have this standard adopted, and hopefully come early next year, we'll be in a place to consider adoption of the MCL. And so if you haven't been paying attention to that process, there's gonna be a number of opportunities to comment, or either during the administrative draft period or the formal rulemaking, which is coming. And the last item I wanted to flag is just our construction stormwater general permit reissuance. Again, many years out of date, about 10 years, I think it expired actually in several years ago. And so our Division of Water Quality has been hard at work updating that permit, working with stakeholders through many, many workshops and discussions over the past few years. And so we had another workshop on that this week, based on some targeted revisions to the general permit update. And we're in a public comment period right now, and potentially we'll be considering adoption of that permit in June. And I believe that is all I had, and happy to take any questions.
That's all you have? Seems like quite a lot.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. I really like the format. I thank you for walking us through the presentation. I'm going to open it up to my colleagues for comments. Any hands or, yes, Ms. Harlan.
Just wanted to say thank you very much for the report, and I've been reappointed to the board, so I'm really happy to be back and work with this wonderful group of board members and staff members.
Great. Congratulations. It's good to have you, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
Thank you.
Chair Gray, for those of us who are watching remotely, I'd like to request that Mr. McGuire stop sharing his screen so we can see everyone who's talking. Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent. Do we have other questions, comments? Dr. Hunter, Vice Chair Wolf?
I always do want to thank Mr. McGuire for covering the most current and urgent work going on at the State Board. It's really helpful to us to know and see where these windows of opportunity are coming. And I know that our staff is very engaged and tracking on how our work is coordinated and supporting many of the priorities set by our governor. And So on our end, we are equally working on our priorities. And I know that you do remain in contact with our chair and our vice chair. And so, but for the public purpose, this is really wonderful to have you give us this broad overview. I do want to just comment on the racial equity process and our meeting yesterday. And I'm glad to know that, as you point out, and I did yesterday as well, these hearings are recorded and accessible. And so I'm glad to know that you'll have a chance to review that. There's always fast forward, I think, during some of our more extended comments. But I think our work on racial equity is something that is extremely challenging, but I think with great purpose. Moving ahead, we will begin to understand some of the ways in which we have not recognized our underserved communities. And I know here in the Central Coast, I know, Mr. McGuire, you are most likely aware of the work we've been doing on environmental justice and certainly working with the Community Water Center and the support and collaboration in exploring stronger, better community engagement. This work that we do comes down to community acceptance, community support, community action. And I'm really heartened to see the State Water Board opening more and more avenues of access. I have, and the virtual dimension of this, I think that's probably my main comment, is the virtual part of this has really opened up the access to people who are very unlikely to get in the car and drive, say from Eureka, where you are. I think you said you were up in the Eureka area today. Those locations, and yet they are facing tremendous shortages and critical entering stages of critical need. So I would encourage, and I think I mentioned this before, and I want to thank you for taking my comments in prior sessions, that I hope we continue to keep these virtual channels open. They're not easy. As we're discovering today, we have a hybrid meeting going on with some of our staff participating remotely from within the building. And but at the same time, the transition is also, I think, important for the public to understand. So everything we can do to promote virtual access, I think ultimately it may take some time to build it, but I hope that we continue to do this. It is a heavy lift. We have technical staff in the room, four or five people who are supporting us here in the room, and I'm sure it's going on upstairs as well in the offices up there. So it isn't an easy thing to do, but I think it's well worth it. And so I hope the state will continue as well, the State Water Board will continue as well to open up these virtual channels to access. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Vice Chair, Dr. Wolf.
Thank you. So Mr. McGuire, thank you for joining us. When I was looking at your graphs about the level amount of precipitation in the Sacramento area in average years, I cannot even count that far because, here where we're located and where the regional board located on, 50-year average is 22.5 inches. And right now we're just shy of 12 inches. But, my comments and questions are going to be aimed specifically at all of these additional fundings coming from the federal government and also from the state of California, which ultimately gets traced to the taxpayers. And I've heard some parties referring to these large opportunities coming as a gold rush for consultants hired by entities to look for additional grants, new grants. And with these opportunities do come the challenges managing these funds properly. I mean, it's one thing to approve a grant or a loan. It's another to make sure that the party will do what they said they're going to do. Our own experience here, when we have had ACLs and agreed to some projects, you know, being done, performed in lieu of, you know, sending the ACL funds to the cleanup and abatement fund. We know firsthand how much work it takes from staff to make sure that, you know, the reports are done on time and things get done as they were supposed to be done. I've heard comment from NGOs that they're concerned where you have some entities pursuing funding and haven't even finished prior projects that they were committing to do, but now sort of moving a different direction. And more recently, last week, I heard comments from some NGOs that there is a need to enhance the transparency of applications to the Office of Finance. And comments were made that, for example, trying to find a grant or an SRF loan application is nearly impossible to do. And I think that's an important part of our job. For example, here, you know, we make significant effort to maintain the proper transparency and, you know, having sunshine is the best form of hygiene and sanitation. So it's a little concerning that, you know, there's this rush of projects and, you know, yourself having an engineering background, you know the complexity of things. And, you know, myself too, I've been in a similar situation in my career. So I understand that the Office of Finance has been increasing staff to manage these applications. The timeline for these applications is also very, very short. So it begs the question, how is all this going to be managed? Understand the legislators, you know, say, hey, we got to push this through. We got to get it all done this year as much as possible by end of the year. So I will summarize, you know, my comment and question in twofold. One, if you can elucidate us a little bit, you know, the recognition in Sacramento and how perhaps, you know, we're going to be able to manage these so the monies are spent at the right place at the right time. And then which I thought was a good point, the aspect of transparency on NGOs or public, you know, being able to have access to information and not having to go through a Public Record Act, which really shouldn't be necessary when, you know, say it's a city applying for a grant. That should be transparent. And it should not be relying on their own websites to find the documentation. So thank you in advance for perhaps what might be a heavy lift in the answer.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you, Vice Chair Wolf. I appreciate the question. I think those are timely and important to be asking those types of questions. And as to how do we know, how are we going to make the best investments possible in good projects that we know will be completed on time and provide the best response to the needs that are out there. And so, you know, we have been augmenting our Division of Financial Assistance staff. I recognize that, you know, it's not just the Division of Financial Assistance that works on these projects, that a lot of times your staff as well gets pulled in. For example, if it were a septic to sewer project that's being funded, you're going to be heavily involved. And there are pressures on your staff and other agencies as well to make these things happen in a timely and efficient manner. So, you know, one thing I looked at is it's how do you balance expediting projects, getting them completed, and at the same time having the right kind of accountability and transparency, as you say. So I know there have been a lot of projects. There's a huge backlog of projects in our SRF program that have been in development for a number of years now. So I do have some confidence that, you know, those projects, hopefully many of them are ready or can be ready in a short timeline. We have a lot of checks in, you know, I actually used to work in the Division of Financial Assistance, so I'm somewhat familiar with our fairly rigorous process to ensure that public entities that are being funded, you know, are doing so in a way that they're going to complete the projects that they start, that they have the technical, managerial, financial capability to do so, that there is accountability through our Office of Enforcement and others, that, you know, the funds are being spent appropriately. It is a challenge. I agree with you. To the extent that information, you know, SRF applications and things aren't being provided, I thought that most of that information was publicly available and accessible through some of our databases, but I will look into that and see what, you know, how we're sharing that information. And certainly, you know, to think that you'd have to go through a PRA request every time you want to know what's going on with a project and where it's at in funding, that's a big lift. And I think we can do better than that if we're not already. So I will look into that for you and get back to you. You know, one of the big concerns and focus areas I think this year is equity in funding. When we have so much funding available, and there are large agencies that are, you know, very sophisticated and themselves have a long backlog of projects, you know, something that's an important priority to me is make sure that the funding is fairly distributed. That, you know, agencies that maybe haven't had a chance to receive funding in the past, they do have very worthwhile projects, can receive it this time around, even with the short timelines that we have. So as we're going through the next couple of months here and looking at our SAFER program, our Safe and Affordable Drinking Water program, and also our broader state revolving fund program policy updates, that's something I'm going to be paying close attention to, just to make sure that we're tracking, we understand where the money is going, which communities have received already significant funding, which ones have significant needs that haven't been met previously, and figure out how do we best balance those investments. So it's a huge challenge. I agree with you completely. And we should keep in close touch as we go forward.
Back. Appreciate that. And then look forward to your follow-up.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you, Biz, for that really thorough, comprehensive update and for the PowerPoint presentation that I think was really helpful in walking us through everything. I'm happy to see that there's an executive order, maybe a little later than I emotionally would have wanted to, mentally would have wanted. I guess my only concern, I think, remains to be the languaging of drought just in general and how we talk about that, you know, at the state level, within, you know, the systems approach of, you know, there seems to be this way out of drought all the time, and I'm just not sure we're there. So maybe just, again, opening our aperture to understand those cycles and talk about them in a more realistic manner helps us prepare. So that's sort of a comment there. I'm just flipping through your slides here. So to the funding, really happy to see the funding. If I missed it, could you just refresh me on sort of the SRF expansion, giving more grants as opposed to loans, and what that means sort of statewide as you implement the program?
Well, yeah, and I'm happy to come back or bring someone from our Division of Financial Assistance to give you more details on that. But we did significantly lower the threshold for grant funding so that many, many more systems are now eligible for grant funding versus low interest loans. So we made it so medium sized systems are now eligible for 100% grant. Disadvantaged communities are medium sized are eligible, which I believe goes up to 30,000 connections. But don't quote me on this. I'm happy to follow up with more specifics if that would be helpful. The loan option a barrier, especially when we're looking at affordability challenges as well. We have this money, we want to get it out, want to see projects completed. So definitely taking steps in that direction.
Excellent. Yeah, I think it would be helpful when you just to streamline some of this to, there is a lot of funding, right? It could be overwhelming. It's a good problem to have that there's funding, but it's important to streamline messaging as it relates to who can get what. And to the further point of drought, I think, the state generally has done an amazing job in mobilizing and helping people get into the right programs, whether it's State Board or DWR or other agencies. I'm really happy to see that cross communication and discussion at the agency level. And I'm sure that that's going to ripple through these programs. So I'm very optimistic about that. As it relates to the draft racial equity action plan that you're moving forward with, as you stated, it is unfortunate you weren't here yesterday. Glad that we do have that recordation option. And as Dr. Hunter said, when we go to tangential conversations, you can forward ahead. But certainly, I think it'll be edifying for you. And we did have a decent amount of discussion, given the fact that, you at State Board have already passed yours. You're moving on to the actual development of the action plan itself. We here at the regional board are the first regional board to sort of be on the leading edge of moving forward with this, hoping to capture some regenerative economies of scale here as we move forward, and again, kind of cross-pollinate as it relates to resources, as it relates to staffing and ideas, ensuring that we're, properly resourced in the regions. I know that your staff has provided a lot of language support, a lot of outreach support. We hope that, that is a sustainable effort. I don't know what all you're doing statewide as you're implementing in terms of language outreach, different types of outreach itself, whether it's written, auditory videos, PSAs, but if there's opportunities to expand the media options in messaging this as we also move forward and expand the access to different languages that can be used for translation and interpretation, I think that would be extremely helpful. And I'm certain other regions would benefit from that as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's certainly something we've been working hard at. And I know you have a Spanish language interpretation being provided right now. And we're definitely always working to improve that capability. And I recognize there are many languages spoken in California, and we want to be as accessible as possible. So completely agree.
Okay, great. Thank you. And of course, just making sure that effort is sustained as we all move forward with development and implementation. Don't have anything else. I'm really actually happy to see that the MCL was released for Chrome 6. It's a long time coming. So good to be moving forward.
Great.
That's all I have, Mr. McGuire. Any other follow-up from So it's 10:30. Would we like to take a break? Break for 15 minutes. We will be back at 10:45. Thank you. Good morning. It's 10:45. We will reconvene the meeting. I'm going to ask Jeremy from AGP to give me a readout of folks who are turning in via the webcast, please.
There are currently 3 viewers.
Thank you very much. Okay, the next item on our agenda is item number 11, Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, Groundwater Assessment and Protection Funds, Status and History. Mr. Keeling.
Thank you, Chair Gray.
right, so item 11, this is an informational item. It's to provide the status update and historical overview of the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, groundwater assessment and protection, otherwise affectionately known as CCAMP GAP funds. CCAMP GAP was established in 2012 and serves as the regional groundwater monitoring component of the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, the CCAMP part. The CCAMP GAP funds are used for the administration and implementation of high priority water quality projects, including the drinking water well testing program and other projects. Julia Dyer of our CCAMP GAP program manager will present this item for you today. With that, I'll turn it over to Julia. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keeling. Sharing my screen now so everyone can see the presentation. Good morning, Chair Gray, members of the board, and happy Earth Day. My name is Julia Dyer, and I'm an environmental scientist on staff here at the Central Coast Water Board. This item is an informational update, and I'm not going to provide you with all the detail provided in the associated staff report, but I will give a high-level overview of the status and history of the fund since inception for the CCAMP GAP program. And the information in this item demonstrates the board's ability to affect meaningful objectives and outcomes through the direction of settlement funds and supplemental environmental projects. I'd like to explain at the outset of this presentation that in addition to CCAMP, our surface water monitoring program, being a separate program from CCAMP GAP, our groundwater monitoring program, CCAMP is also supported by separate funds. This presentation and associated staff report addresses CCAMP GAP funds exclusively. Finally, for the purposes of this presentation and staff report, all numbers have been rounded to 2 or 3 significant digits. The Central Coast region is the most groundwater dependent region in the state, with nearly 90% of the population relying on groundwater for drinking water and other uses. Some areas of the region are entirely dependent on groundwater. To protect this resource, the purpose of CCAMP GAP is to develop and implement regional groundwater monitoring programs and to support the implementation of groundwater related projects with the intent of evaluating, restoring, and protecting the beneficial uses of groundwater in the Central Coast region. The data and information collected through the implementation of CCAMP GAP projects inform actions of the Central Coast Water Board, local agencies, and other entities to protect groundwater quality and public health and to evaluate the effectiveness of those actions. To achieve its purpose, CCAMP GAP funded projects substantially align with the mission and priorities defined by the state board, regional water boards, as well as the state water board's supplemental environmental projects policy, or SEP policy. Projects funded to date through CCAMP GAP have implemented the priorities listed in the first 4 bullets of this slide, such as monitoring, environmental justice, and service to underrepresented communities. The last 2 bullets, climate change and sustainable water supplies, are additional priorities within additional funding. We are hoping to address them through future projects. I'll speak about CCAMP GAP funded projects in further detail later in this presentation. The CCAMP GAP program was established via resolution approved by the Central Coast Water Board in May 2012. Later that year, Central Coast Water Board and the Bay Foundation of Morro Bay, or the Bay Foundation, entered into a fund agreement. The fund grant agreement established the Bay Foundation as the third-party administrator of the CCAMP GAP program. As the third-party administrator, the Bay Foundation oversees the endowment and operational accounts, enters into contract agreements, and coordinates with the Central Coast Water Board. Another benefit of working with the Bay Foundation is due to its relationship with the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, the Bay Foundation must comply with federal procurement and contracting requirements and participate in federal financial audits. This table provides a summary of the CCAMP Gap Fund's current status. The balances are current as of November 2021. The funds are held in two accounts. The endowment account is an actively managed investment account that builds revenue for the program. The operational account is a non-investment cash account that facilitates project expenditure and administrative fee payments. There is currently $3 million in the endowment. Central Coast Water Board staff's initial goal in 2012 was to increase the endowment to $5 million over 10 years. But recent estimates by the Central Coast Water Board staff indicate that a minimum endowment of $6.5 million is needed to sustain annual revenues sufficient to administer CCAMP GAP and implement priority water quality projects. The $147,000 balance in the operational account includes both encumbered and unencumbered funds. Encumbered funds are obligated to existing contracts. There's currently one existing contract through CCAMP GAP, which is the Central Coast Drinking Water Well Testing Program. Unencumbered funds are not contractually obligated. They are therefore available to pay administrative and management fees and other expenses. The current total amount of CCAMP GAP funds is $3.1 million. This table provides a summary of CCAMP GAP's funds received into the program and spent since inception. This includes $5.1 million in income and $2 million in expenses. The $5.1 million in income was derived from Central Coast Water Board approved allocation of settlement monies, investment gains and interest, and third-party SEP funds. The $2 million in expenses include expenditures for projects and administrative and management fees. The net income, which is the total income minus total expenses, equals $3.1 million, which matches the amount currently held in the CCAMP GAP funds as shown in the previous slide. As promised, I'd like to share some detail regarding CCAMP GAP funded projects. A total of 9 projects have been funded since inception. CCAMP GAP projects have been and continue to successfully address the established funding priorities I described earlier in this presentation. Many of the projects are coordinated and leverage efforts in order to address the priorities. As I mentioned, there is currently one active project, the Central Coast Drinking Water Well Testing Program. This project provides free well testing throughout the Central Coast region with an emphasis on underrepresented communities. The information and data generated through this program furthers the human right to water and addresses environmental justice. For more details, an annual program update is provided in Attachment 2 of Item 3, the Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Annual Update. Examples of completed projects include the Drinking Water Well Testing Pilot Program in San Luis Obispo County. The data from this project is publicly available, and the lessons learned from this project inform the current well testing program. The contract with the Community Water Center established and expanded environmental justice capacity on the Central Coast. The Community Water Center continues to provide outreach and education in support of the well testing program. In turn, the Drinking Water Well Testing Program provides data to the Community Water Center to inform their work with underrepresented communities. In summary, in the nearly 10 years since its establishment, CCAMP GAP has proven to be an effective and efficient program that meets critical high priority needs through supporting programs and projects that address the Central Coast Water Board's highest priorities, such as identifying water quality related threats to human health and increasing environmental justice capacity in the region. Also, as the program's third-party administrator, the Bay Foundation provides effective funds management. Regarding next steps, CCAMP GAP The CCAMP GAP program will continue to support priority programs and projects with an emphasis on service to underrepresented communities, pursue opportunities to increase the endowment, and provide regular updates to the Central Coast Water Board. That concludes the presentation, and I'd like to now open it up to discussion and questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dyer. I'd like to open it up to my board colleagues. Questions, comments? Dr. Hunter, Vice Chair Wolf, Dr. Hunter.
Yes, thank you. Julia, Ms. Dyer, for that report. And I think probably the most important thing you clarified for me is the relationship in funding versus the data sets. So the CCAMP data set and GAP program manage their own data sets, but I was unaware that CCAMP itself has a separate funding stream. So that's really important. And I am I'm also glad to see, as we have begun to identify ways in which we are utilizing both our technical resources, our technical knowledge, and our programmatic resources to address environmental justice and human right to water. And certainly the free well testing program is one of those key programs core to everything. I think Ms. Schroeder is there with you, and she and I have talked over many times about the transition that occurred once data on wells, private wells, domestic wells, once that data started to become establish a baseline and we started to see the trends, that we began to see a different kind of dialogue going on with the environmental health, county agencies and so forth, as well as our work with the Community Water Center being a big part of that, utilizing, you know, everything, including money. So this is really important to see. I think I'll let it go at that, but thank you again for a very good presentation.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Sorry, Ms. Dyer. Yes, Vice Chair, Dr. Wolf. You are on mute.
Okay. No, I'm legal. So happy Friday to you, Julia. And you know, when you gave your presentation, I thought that was a perfect example of good transparency in information, because you know, earlier with our state board liaison discussed the challenges to have access to information, the accountability and transparency of information, of fundings, et cetera. And I think you gave us today a perfect illustration of you know, a good example of how things should be done. So the public at large certainly can see how these funds are being used. And you know, one positive for sure is over the years, the endowment has consistently been very fiscally prudent on how to approach this. And you know, let alone the end products, which are the various water quality testing program you had, you know, have had always very good technical foundation. So I will say, you know, thumbs up. And, you know, in full disclosure, I know at times, you know, Sacramento has viewed having local endowments with a little bit of trepidations in terms of how, you know, how regional boards manage some funds versus having funds centralized through Sacramento. But I think this is a very good example and a positive example that it can be done, it can be done right, and the money gets spent locally and with very good purposes. So anyway, thank you, appreciate all your efforts.
Thank you, Ms. Dyer. I too just want to applaud this staff report. I think it's extremely clear. Obviously, the program is really well managed, and you know, it really just underscores the unique component of our hydrologic region and being the primacy of groundwater for folks in our area. And certainly, you know, the opportunity to have a C-CAMP gap program overall, I think gives us a leg up on SGMA, right? And we're sort of, you know, out in front in some of those regards. And it's really important to have, you know, opportunities to share that data transparently ahead of what was required through SGMA. So those are my comments. I see Mr. Keeling has his hand up.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Just want to make sure that it's clear to everyone who's listening today that Central Coast Water Board and our staff, we don't manage these funds. It's the Bay Foundation that manages these funds. Board member Dr. Hunter talked earlier today as part of her Earth Day introductory remarks about the National Estuary Program in Morro Bay and, you know, the federal funding that they get. And one of the things that I've noticed over the years, and the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, which works closely and under the funding administration of the Bay Foundation, they don't get a lot of federal funding. But one of the things that is just amazing about the Morro Bay National Estuary Program and their relationship with the Bay Foundation in that the staffing that they support through the federal funding they get, they leverage other sources of funding through grants. And they do a lot of amazing work above and beyond the level of funding that they get through EPA in support of that National Estuary Program. And our C-CAMP and our C-CAMP GAP programs are really key examples of that. Just enough to clarify that and to give credit to our National Estuary Program and Bay Foundation program partners. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, they're the only folks here in the room with us. Thank you very much for being here. Did you have any public comment at all? Anything you wanted to say? Okay.
Well, actually, could I put you on the spot? And
feel free to come up to the podium.
I understand that you've recently joined the staff, and I think that would be something we'd all like to hear about if you could just briefly update us.
Sure, Monica. Thank you for having me. This is a great program and a great partnership, a great project. That I think
for the record, would you mind introducing yourself?
Oh, please? Sure. Melody Grubbs, Executive Director, Morro Bay National Estuary Program. Having recently started, I'm on month number two. It's been great transitioning into the program, and actually my interactions with the National Estuary Program began over a decade ago while I was working at the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo, so I do have some roots established in the area. They were actually one of my first clients as an independent contractor working on eelgrass mapping back when eelgrass was really in decline. Happy to report, coming on as executive director, we are seeing really good numbers in eelgrass in the Bay, which is really exciting. And it shows, I think, a lot of the work that our staff has done in trying to coordinate with different agencies to restore some of these critical habitats in the Bay. Working with Julia has been great. She's definitely gotten me up to speed on all the collaborations that we've done over the past. And this presentation was a good example and summary of this program. So yeah, I'm happy to be here and happy to look forward to continued collaborations in the years to come. I think this is a great program and a great way to support local priority needs while leveraging different sources of funding to get more work done. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, you bring a lot of expertise and financial heft, certainly, that we appreciate, as well as the data. And it's good to hear some positive news as it relates to restoration of habitat. So thank you. Any other dialogue on this? Okay, seeing none, we will move on to action item number 12, Pacific Gas and Electric Company settlement discussion and the proposed funding allocation plan. Mr. Keeling.
Thank you, Chair Gray. So as you mentioned, item 12 is an action item, and it's for the board to consider adoption of a proposed resolution, number R3-2022-15. And this is to allocate $5.9 million received from Pacific Gas and Electric Company as part of a settlement agreement. The PG&E settlement funds present a really unique opportunity for the board to allocate funding towards water quality priorities that achieve multiple benefits in the short and long term throughout our region. Water board staff coordinated with the subcommittee of the board, and a number of the board members today highlighted some of those more recent meetings that they had with staff. These subcommittee meetings occurred between August 2021 and March 2022 to consider alternative funding scenarios and develop the funding allocation plan framework that informed the proposal in front of the board today. In addition to staff, they also conducted a robust public process and broadly distributed draft documents in both Spanish and English. They considered input received from the subcommittee and public comments, also considered regional priorities and needs, and the Water Board's supplemental environmental project policy to prepare the proposed funding allocation plan. Again, we'll hear from Julia Dyer, our CCAMP GAP program manager, who will present this item to you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keeling. So as Mr. Keeling stated, this is an action item for the board to consider the proposed resolution to allocate $5.9 million in settlement funds from PG&E. In this presentation, I'll provide an overview of the Central Coast Water Board staff's proposed funding allocation plan for the settlement funds. We'll start with some history. The $5.9 million settlement was ordered through a consent judgment issued by the San Luis Obispo County Superior Court. The settlement resolves alleged NPDES permit cooling water thermal violations at the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. This action to allocate the settlement funds is not related to the regulation or closure of the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. Funding was received last summer, and since that time, the funding has been held in a non-investment cash account. The consent judgment states that PG&E's one-time payment of over $5.9 million will benefit water quality and the environment on the Central Coast. The Bay Foundation will distribute funds from the one-time payment as directed by the Central Coast Water Board. There are no other constraints for the distribution of these funds. Unlike current enforcement settlements, the PG&E settlement funds discussed in this item are not subject to the State Water Board's Supplemental Environmental Projects Policy, or SEP policy. This is because the settlement negotiations arose prior to the SEP policy. Therefore, the Central Coast Water Board has some discretion and flexibility to allocate the settlement funds and implement projects. Nonetheless, the recommended funding allocation plan substantially aligns with the SEP policy by ensuring that funded projects have environmental value, furthering the enforcement goals, policies, and mission of the water boards, and applying appropriate oversight to ensure projects are effectively implemented. When developing this proposed funding allocation plan, staff considered how to achieve multiple high priority objectives in both the short and the long term. To accomplish this, Water Board staff is proposing a funding allocation plan which distributes the fund over three categories as shown in this table. The first category proposes an allocation of $4.1 million to build the endowment for the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, Groundwater Assessment and Protection, also known as CCAMP GAP. The second category provides $600,000 to the Central Coast Drinking Water Well Testing Program. The third and final category recommends $1.2 million for the public solicitation of grant projects through the establishment and implementation of the Central Coast Community-Based Water Quality Grants Program. Now I'll get into some detail regarding each of the funding categories. The first category proposes an increase of the CCAMP Gap Endowment. The CCAMP Gap Endowment was discussed in further detail in the previous item. An increase in the CCAMP Gap Endowment by $4.1 million would bring the principal up to approximately $6.5 million. Based on a three-year investment period and an estimated 5% rate of return, and dependent on market fluctuations, the endowment would produce an annual revenue stream of approximately $325,000. A well-funded endowment will increase the long-term financial capacity of the CCAMP Gap program through an annual revenue stream to support the implementation of high-priority groundwater work. High-priority groundwater work includes the ongoing implementation of the Central Coast Drinking Water Well Testing Program, Bay Foundation Project Administration to provide oversight and implementation of projects and to pursue and leverage additional funding opportunities. And finally, revenue for future projects that address CCAMP Gap established priority funding areas. The second funding allocation category directs $600,000 to the drinking water well testing program. Funding is needed now to continue the well testing program as the current contract is nearing the end of its funding. Water Board staff estimates that $600,000 would continue the program for approximately 3 years. Starting in year four and beyond, the program would be supported by the annual revenue stream generated by the CCAMP Gap Endowment. The third funding category allocates $1.2 million to establish and implement the Central Coast Community-Based Water Quality Grants Program to conduct a public solicitation for grants projects and oversee the selected projects. The program will be implemented by a third-party administrator, the Rose Foundation for Communities and the Environment. The public solicitation could commence in early 2023. I'll be talking about project criteria in the next slides, and they align with the Water Board priorities. The implementation of the grants program will include the distribution of $1 million in PG&E settlement funds to a wide variety of projects that benefit water quality and the environment in the Central Coast region through a publicly solicited competitive process. The remaining $200,000 is reserved for the administrative fee. The Rose Foundation is a grant-making public charity founded in 1992 and based out of Oakland, California. They have extensive experience in managing community-based environmental projects, building long-term solutions, and coordinating with the regional water quality control boards, specifically in Los Angeles with Region 4 and in the Central Valley with Region 5. Due to this, they have a knowledge of the state board's SEP policy. The Rose Foundation has confirmed that they will be able to conduct this process in alignment with established funding priority areas. The grants program will award funding through one of two grant tracks. Large grants include a more extensive grant application with award amounts ranging from $100,000 to $200,000 and a primary focus towards public agencies and larger nonprofits. Small grants include a simplified grant application with award amounts ranging from $20,000 to $50,000 and a primary focus towards smaller-based nonprofits. These funding tracks small grants, but right-size the application and reporting process so that smaller groups and larger agencies are competing for grant dollars on an even playing field. Additionally, the Grow Your Roots Technical Assistance Mini Grants Program, as part of the Grassroots Training Institute, would take place concurrently. This provides the opportunity for the grantees who are awarded a small grant to also participate in an organizational capacity assessment to identify capacity needs. Grantees who participate in this program can receive up to $1,000 in additional targeted grant funding based on specific need to help increase their capacity in specific areas. Examples include capacity building training, purchasing software, or hiring a consultant. Boosting a group's back office capacity will help achieve greater success in all program work. This slide provides a list of the ranking and selection criteria for the grants program. Further details on project ranking and selection is included in attachment 2 of the staff report for this item. I'm not going to read all the criteria on this list to you, but projects that address one or more of these criteria will be considered high priority for funding. These are consistent with C-Camp GAP funding priorities and include the human right to water, environmental justice, and service to underrepresented communities. Also, selection and ranking will be based on additional criteria such as grantee eligibility, applicant quality, project readiness, and grantee history. The Rose Foundation's process includes the establishment of a funding advisory board. This is an established model that provides the local knowledge and watershed expertise which grounds the program. This is included as part of the Rose Foundation's administrative fee. The funding advisory board will include 3 to 5 individuals with knowledge of the Central Coast and its watersheds, water quality issues, and community-based environmental stewardship work. The advisory board is subject to the Rose Foundation's conflict of interest policy. The advisory board process includes identification of potential applicants, review of applications, application of the selection criteria, and the recommendation of grant projects. Central Coast Water Board staff will have a very limited role in this process, if at all. We will remain available to provide information and data to the Rose Foundation as needed, and the advisory board as well, and to provide input when vetting applicants and projects if needed. The grants program solicitation schedule would run approximately 3 years. The first year includes grant project solicitation, recruiting the funding advisory board, distribution of large and small grant track funds, and active engagement for the technical assistance mini grants. During the second year, the Rose Foundation will provide oversight of grant projects, conduct capacity assessments, and award technical assistance mini grants. Finally, in year 3, the grant projects would conclude. I'd like to emphasize that this schedule includes the Rose Foundation providing reporting to the board annually. This is the ideal schedule, but there is some flexibility. Should a project need more than 3 years to complete, or if all the funding is not distributed within the first year? I'll now shift to a discussion of the public process and associated with this item. The documents associated with this item were released for a 30-day public comment period starting on January 31st and ending on March 2nd, 2022. The documents distributed for public comment included the proposed resolution, staff report, and draft ranking and selection criteria. The documents were distributed broadly in both English and Spanish. A summary of the public comments and Water Board staff responses is provided in attachment 3 to the staff report. We received 2 comment letters, one from the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, and the other from Creeklands Conservation. The comments primarily focused on recommending specific project types. The draft ranking and selection criteria provided in attachment 2 to the staff report prioritizes specific criteria such as human right to water and underrepresented communities, but does not generally exclude project types. The projects identified in the comment letters are eligible but may not meet the highest priorities. There are no recommended changes based on the public comments. In summary, these 3 proposed funding allocation categories enable the Central Coast Water Board to meet multiple high priority objectives and to balance immediate needs and long-term benefits. Additionally, the projects prioritized for funding associated with these categories substantially align with the mission of the Water Boards as well as the State Water Board's SEP policy. Additionally, the proposed resolution presents a very unique opportunity for the Central Coast Water Board to allocate a large amount of funding to the Seacamp Gap Endowment and to establish the grants program. It is unlikely an opportunity like this will be available again. Central Coast Water Board staff recommends that the Central Coast Water Board approve the resolution as proposed. This concludes my presentation, and I'll now open things up for discussion and questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dyer. I'm going to open it up to board discussion. Yes, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. And once again, Ms. Dyer, thank you for a very well organized presentation and a lot of information and some new components here to really take into account. I'm glad to know that this particular opportunity, which seems to be something that we might not see again coming our way. So very good to see the endowment now. $5,000 annual seems like a reasonable amount to see some good work going on. So, and the course dedicated funds to continue the free well testing program at $600,000. Do we have an estimate for fertilization in this hearing with the different staff reports? Do we have an estimate on how many more wells that would provide for, or how much time, either one of those metrics?
We're estimating that will carry the program through 3 years so that we can get to year four when we can start collecting annual revenue from the endowment. And the estimates for how many wells that would be is a little more difficult because projects are more expensive than they were when the current project was, or the current contract was established. But we're hoping for at least 200 wells a year with that amount of money, give or take.
That's pretty good.
It is, yeah.
I mean, right now we're sitting at 420. And do we have an estimate of how many wells? What is the total number of domestic wells that potentially could be tested? I thought I saw somewhere it was like 1,800 in this region.
Maybe Matt Keeling can jump in if I get this wrong, but the estimate I see is that there's 44,000 wells in the region.
Drinking water wells?
Correct. Domestic wells.
Okay, I don't know what the 1,800 was that I had in mind, but
it is just an estimate because there is no centralized place that we know all the wells. But that's the estimate I've heard.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Keeling, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, just to confirm, those are our best estimates based on census data as it relates to our rural communities.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a 40,000 or above.
Okay. Yeah. That's good to know. I don't think I've ever asked that before, so it's a big number. And then within that 600,000 and the I'm guessing anticipating that includes outreach and education monies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. And will that money be in coordination with Community Water Center and what they're doing, or is it further afield?
I would say both. We would continue to partner with them. They're an excellent partner, but we want to extend our well testing into the south. And of course we would coordinate with any equivalent agency that would help us with education and outreach on that.
Yeah, right. And so that reminds me that Santa Barbara is a county that we have yet to really start to do well testing. And so would these monies be available to go in that direction?
Absolutely. That's the plan. Before the pandemic hit, we were going to do a rollout in Santa Cruz County, which is underrepresented in that data, and then following Santa Barbara County, which we have less than a dozen tests in there. I think we have some incidental ones out of Santa Maria, but no robust amount of sampling in Santa Barbara. So they're on deck for that.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Yeah. All right. So Then the other question I wanted to ask about, the other aspect of this I wanted to ask about is the community-based water quality grants program. This is new. So can you give me a little bit more about the thinking behind that and how, what is it we hope to accomplish? 1 million in 1 year, is that right?
1 million to be distributed in the first year, but projects to take place over a 3-year period.
Okay.
And we would like it to reflect the goals of the CCAMP GAP funding priorities, such as the human right to water, environmental justice, so forth. Angela, do you want to speak more to that?
Sure. Thanks, Julia. So as you can see from Julia's recommended allocation plan, we really tried to hit all areas, right? So we have the long-term endowment, we have our immediate needs for the drinking water testing program, and we also did want to provide a substantial opportunity for the community. And this community-based water quality grants program is really, I want to say kudos to the Rose Foundation for their very substantial models and success in this area. They've done a great job, not just for water quality, but for all areas, air quality, environmental protection all over the nation. Right. So they have a very established program, which really focuses on the underserved communities, so that they have a very strong focus. So our goals are to really to provide a substantial amount of funding to the community directly as aligned with our priorities. And in speaking with the Rose Foundation, they suggested this large and small track model with knowing our cost allocation of approximately $1 million, thinking that that would lead to a very robust program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in the past with our SEP programs, I think we discovered that administration of these grants is really a burden for staff to really track and assure deliverables. And as challenges occurred, especially in some of the smaller SEP projects, that it just really was time consuming for staff. So this is really a bonus to us to have this new partnership.
I could just add, Dr. Hunter, because you reminded me that you're correct, it's not an insignificant administrative process. So I wanted to recognize that the funding advisory board model, right, this mini grants model, the outreach that they do in terms of how they go into the local network of nonprofits is already built within the administrative cost of this grants. Whereas I think that's a significant amount of work, like you said. So other organizations, and frankly us, if we were ever to have to do, we'd have to completely build that right from the ground up in order to be successful.
Very true. And I also, I'm very aware of the Rose Foundation for at least the last 15 years through my work with the Planning Conservation League Foundation. They've the Rose Foundation has really elevated the possibility for these small level grants and projects, one-time funding. So I was really excited to see the Rose Foundation getting involved, and they're well known, as you point out, so that community groups looking for funding for small restoration projects and so forth, that's high on their list. So it looks like we could have a good nexus there. I just wanted a little bit more information about the funding advisory board and the selection process for that. How, because it notes it in the staff report or in attachment two, it notes that the funding advisory board will be the criteria for selecting those members of the advisory board is that both local knowledge of the Central Coast region as well as some technical expertise. What do you have in mind, or how will that work, or is it entirely up to the Rose Foundation?
The short answer is it's entirely up to the Rose Foundation. Okay. We will defer to them for that.
I answered my own question.
Yeah.
Okay. What's that?
I think the Rose Foundation submitted a speaker card in case there are specific questions. So think we have them online.
Correct. They're online. So if you do have a question for them, we can ask them to join the meeting.
Yeah, that would be, I just wonder,
because it seems that they're going to form this advisory board specific to this grant program. And I'm guessing they have experience in, as you said, the many models that they have for administrating grant programs. I'd love it if they're interested in speaking to this issue a little more.
Absolutely, we can certainly.
So the folks from the Rose Foundation that are participating in this meeting are Tim Little, who's the director, and then Jodine Isaacs, who would be our direct contact for the grant funding program.
Jodine, you've been moved up to panelist, and I don't see Tim Little.
Okay. Jodine can answer this question because we've discussed it.
So as for the funding board, first, hello, and thank you all for the opportunity to talk about Rose and how we work a little bit. Also, thank you very much to Julia Dyer, who's done a great job in coordinating this. So our model for grant making is most often when we can, we employ funding boards. We really believe in a transparent process, and all of our grants we make available on our website, and the funding board members, we usually post on our website as well. And it's been our experience that using folks based in the community and with expertise in a field or helping us connect to Nexus has made us make better grants, make better decisions. And so for this project, because we have a lot of grantees previous from our community or watershed grants that are in Region 3, and I expect that we would draw on initially people that groups that we've worked with and have a track record and have good history with their projects in Region 3. And they have ability, you know, capacity and interest in joining us. We would have them serve on funding board. And we also mentioned that if there's staff or the regional board has specific communities in mind that they would really like to see reflected in board, I mean, we're happy to do outreach. But we do have a pretty good network of folks that we've worked with in Region 3. And so that's basically drawing on our history is how we would expect to populate the funding board.
Thank you. I appreciate the context in which, you know, this will occur. And I do really value the fact that it's the local presence, local knowledge is a priority, and I think could assure us that we're going to see the kinds of projects that we, you know, have been in planning and design and with local stakeholders are as important as the actual goal and purpose and mission of the sharing that information with us. And thank you for participating today so that we could probe a little bit further into how this this will take place and how it'll take shape.
Pleasure. And we're really excited about, you know, developing this with staff as if it's approved and we move forward. So thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. And that's really all my questions.
Okay. Do we have any other questions or comments? Ms. Harlan, Vice Chair Wolf.
You're on mute.
I know.
Okay.
Give me 3 seconds to make the click. Thank you. So first, I wanna thank the team that worked for several months to get to where we are today in this proposed funding allocation plan. There was a lot of good dialogue, give and take, and trying to come up with something that was fair and balanced. So I want to thank all the staff participation as a whole. The second quick comment I wanted to make is that I'm encouraged to see what I'll call a bit of an effort toward diversification of beneficiaries of grants. Because Similarly to the point I made earlier with our state board liaison, Mr. Maguire, where you have, for example, city entities that have a small army of consultants who are paid to pursue grants. And it seems that it's always the same folks who get the grants because they've done it before and they have all the resource to do it. Well, the same thing happens sometime with, you know, different nonprofit organizations without naming them. You know, some of them have a significant success of turning on grants after grants. And then you have folks who are a little bit more in the fringes. So I'm encouraged to see, particularly with the Rose Foundation and then maintaining the legal arm's length relations that we have to maintain. We didn't talk about that, but that's a requirement for our water board of this particular project. It'll help also maintain, you know, the neutrality from the board involvement, but also because of the experience of the Rose Foundation, you know, having a broader net, I think you can cast with a bigger net. I'll use the analogy of some of the smaller fish out there that haven't been able to benefit from various grants programs. So again, thank you everyone. I'm personally very happy to see that, you know, the team here that will hopefully this resolution is approved by my fellow board members will bring this to, you know, a very successful story. Thank you. And also thank you for the Rose Foundation to take time of your day to participate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Dyer and Ms. Schroeder, for the presentation. I just had a couple of an outreach, and thank you, Ms. Isaacs and Mr. Little, for being here. Thanks, Julia, for your presentation. It was really very clear. So, you know, we had a discussion at our board yesterday related to racial equity and racial justice. And I'm not sure if either one of you, Ms. Isaacs or Mr. able to listen to them, you know, how these funds can benefit some of those communities and in the outreach that you're conducting, if there's opportunities to sort of message out what, you know, what the goals are of what we're working on, some of our priorities, and how this funding can impact some of those communities.
I'll take the first stab at answering that. In terms of, you know, just as background, the mission of the Rose Foundation, or the lens that we do pretty much all our grant making, whether it be in the context of water, air quality, or land use, or even our consumer protection grant making that we do, is part of, I saw first couple hours of yesterday's presentation. And yeah, I mean, I think that the reason why staff reached out to us is that they see the overlap between the work that, you know, we've been doing for decades. And it's in line with how the regional board is wanting to go forward in terms of environmental justice and equity. So we give preference to environmental justice in terms of ranking projects. So that's kind of already part and parcel. Messaging in disadvantaged communities, is that?
No, I was really just asking you to amplify that discussion, sort of demonstrating to members of the public that we are, you know, walking the talk as we move forward with this historic investment, both in our endowment and this grant making, that provides us ready opportunities to, you know, infuse resources into communities that we discussed just yesterday, and that certainly have been beleaguered by environmental justice and racial equity issues for a long time. So, yeah, if you'd like to delve into you know, how you're going to go about doing that, be happy to hear that. So, you know, you have a good legacy. We're very excited to be working with you, but I think it might be helpful to illuminate some of your practices for not everybody that's familiar with you.
I'm going to let Tim kind of delve into that since he has more context on history. But that's kind of the initial thing, is it's already baked into our process. And in terms of, you know, we are expecting to use the, I believe it's attached as item two. I mean, the framework that staff has already created is our jumping off point in terms of ranking projects as they come in, and giving highest consideration to the environmental justice policy and the criteria. I mean, it's reflected in the ranking criteria, I guess. But Tim, if you would like to, you know, jump off, take it.
Okay, thanks very much. Chair Gray, members of the board, Executive Officer Keeling, I appreciate the chance to be here to talk to you today. I especially appreciate what we're talking about is the concept that your board is going to entrust a significant amount of money to the Rose Foundation, specifically for the purpose of funding community-based water quality work in the Central Coast. And as Jodine said, building in environmental justice and projects that don't just benefit disadvantaged communities, but that come from disadvantaged communities and involve disadvantaged communities is baked into the criteria of the grants program. And just, I mean, quite frankly, projects that have those elements are going to score higher and get preference in funding. And that does reflect the Rose Foundation's long-term philosophy. There's a reason why we're the Rose Foundation for communities and the environment, because our whole mission is to work at the intersection of people and do it at a very local, grassroots way. In big picture, we just completed, I'll share this, we just completed a racial justice training for all Rose Foundation staff, and it was a culmination of a year's effort of internal conversations. And we're in the process of now talking about how we implement recommendations to go even further in centering all of our grants programs around equity and justice. In addition to this program, a lot of our work has centered around directing funding from Clean Water Act mitigation settlements and other types of mitigation settlements back to benefit impacted communities. And we've, to put it in the words of one of our grantees that was helping lead a How to Apply webinar for our Fund Up in Puget Sound last year, she said, the thing you have to understand is that this was the context, it's the Puget Sound Watershed and Stewardship Fund. She was telling people, you have to understand, this is a single issue fund because we're accountable, the Rose Foundation's accountable to the court and the U.S. Justice Department for that fund to use the money to support local water quality projects. But that the point is that people don't live single issue lives, and the real projects and the kind of benefits that will be lasting come from intersectional and come from understanding that that a project that's doing food justice and planning food for hungry people, they were talking about a project that was breaking up concrete and helping groundwater infiltration. And that's the lens that we bring to this program. So we're going to be applying, that, and those projects are going to get priority and preference. We have a multicultural staff at the Rose Foundation and a high degree of English, Spanish bilingual fluency, including a number of native Spanish speakers. And we routinely produce our materials in English and Spanish. Also our trainings, grantee trainings, and convening multilingual. Ensure that we're getting, they know this money is available and they know how to apply for it. and they know where the bullseyes are, and they can navigate the process. As Jodine started to talk about our funding board, we will be looking for them for recruiting our funding board. We'll be starting with our grantees and folks on the ground who have been working in communities in the Central Coast for many years and are trusted community messengers. And they're going to help us identify and take an outreach list, which is already robust. We already have a pretty strong grants database, but we'll build on that to really target and make sure that we get the word out. Let me stop here. I can talk all day about the Rose Foundation, but I'll stop here.
Happy to listen. I really appreciate that discussion. And I think it really demonstrates, again, you know, just the laudable aspects of the work that you're doing, the legacy that you bring. And, you know, we're really happy to be working with you on this project, given the historic investment, really, that we have to make. And it's we have opportunities for latitude over this funding. And to you to manage. Any other comments, questions? No. Yes.
Yeah, just a quick information augmentation going back to Dr. Hunter's conversation pertaining to the number of drinking water wells and our executive officer feedback. The question was, you get approximately 44,000 wells. There was discussion of how many wells are being tested, but I wanted to remind all of us that we have about 4,000 drinking water wells being tested in the next 2 months as part of Agriculture Order 4.0. So that's another chunk of wells that are being tested. I just wanted to augment that information. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. So if there aren't any further questions or comments, this is an action item. And thank you again, Mr. Little and Ms. Isaacs, for joining us for the meeting, for entertaining our questions.
We do have a public speaker, Chair Gray.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Olson. Is this Mr. Bollinger?
Yes.
Thank you.
And he has been promoted and can speak when you're ready.
Okay, do we want to put the timer up?
AGP?
Give us a moment.
Just a moment of patience, Mr. Bollinger.
No worries.
Nice to see you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you all.
So we can't put the timer up without blocking him. So
okay, so
we can run the timer and let you know when it's over.
That would be great. Yeah, okay. Thank you so much. Go ahead, Mr. Bollinger.
Great. Well, thank you, Chair Gray, members of the board and staff at the Regional Water Board. My name is Brandon Bollinger. I work with Community Water Center, and I'm the Community Advocacy Manager. I just wanted to comment and highlight the importance of these funding opportunities for work that goes towards the human right to water and environmental justice work. I've been working very closely in connecting folks to the well testing program and see firsthand how important it is for folks to access water quality information and understand what's in their water and how to get resources if there is contamination. So these funding opportunities are really, really important to connect people to opportunities to learn more. I think a lot of my comments that I prepared have been answered by both Jodine and Tim with the Rose Foundation, and really appreciate their responses to the board's questions. I was planning on highlighting the importance of making sure that the process to apply for these grants should be transparent and simple so that folks can access these types of grant opportunities. Many people have highlighted between yesterday and today, the challenges of doing environmental justice work and how difficult this can be. And so I think being able to access funds that are both transparent as far as how to apply for it, but then also what reporting looks like, I think is really important in order to help focus the work more towards impact and not so much on the processes related to applying and then also reporting. And so really just appreciate Jodine and Tim, your reflections on the questions and clarity on that. And thanks to the board for your time and happy Earth Day to everybody.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate the comment and happy Earth Day to you as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Yep.
I'm yes, ready Dr. to Wolf. Make a motion.
Yep. Lots of people are.
So I would like to make a motion to approve a proposed resolution R3-2022-0015 for funding allocation plan.
I will second.
Maybe have a roll call, please.
Chair Gray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Member Ireland? Member Hunter?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So it's 11:51. I have a couple of options for folks here. We can press through on our next enforcement item. And then close the meeting, frankly, and go into closed session and have lunch. Or we can break for lunch now and then reconvene and finish out our enforcement items. Do we have a preference? I have a preference, but I will open it up to my board colleagues.
I can go either way. If you feel there's a benefit to staff to just continue the meeting and wrap it up so they can get on with their day, that seems like might be a good way to go, but I'm open either way.
Okay, I think that's an efficient use of time. Ms. Harlan?
I agree. Either one is fine with me, whatever it works out for the staff members too.
Okay, Vice Chair Wolf?
Yeah, my mouse was stuck, so sorry. I also would suggest to just to continue, and that way we make efficient use of the time.
Thank you. I will suggest we take a 10-minute break just to stretch and refresh ourselves, and then reconvene here at a few minutes, 2 minutes after noon, so that we can move on to item number 13. Is that okay with everyone?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So we'll be back at 12:03. Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks for your patience as we got up and running. AGP, do you want to report out how many?
Sure. AGP is happy to report as of now, we've had 29 total visitors.
Excellent. Up 26 people. Thank you very much. Okay, so we will reconvene here. We are on agenda item number 13. This is an enforcement item. Enforcement report and supplemental environmental and enhanced compliance action program update. Mr. Keeling.
Chair Gray. Well, for lucky item 13 today, Tamara Anderson of our staff, she's our Central Coast Water Board enforcement coordinator. She'll be providing a brief overview of the enforcement report for you today, which includes updates on recent enforcement actions and supplemental environmental projects and enhanced compliance action projects. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tamara.
Thank you, Mr. Keeling. So good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. I'm Tamara Anderson, a senior water resource control engineer specialist and the Region 3 enforcement coordinator, as Matt mentioned. And this item includes two components, the regular enforcement quarterly update, and then also an update on individual supplemental environmental projects, SEPs, and enhanced compliance action, ECA, projects that are either completed or in progress since May of 2021. So attachment one of the staff report includes enforcement actions taken from the beginning of September through the end of February 2022. And table one in attachment one includes issued administrative civil liability ACL orders. And you'll see the first three ACLs resolve mandatory minimum penalties for effluent limit violations from wastewater treatment plants. And then the last two ACLs are discretionary ACL orders resolved through settlement. And the first settlement is with the City of Greenfield for unauthorized discharge of 3 million gallons of treated municipal wastewater from Greenfield's wastewater treatment plant that discharged to the Salinas River floodplain and groundwater. It was an unauthorized discharge because the treated effluent went to an area not covered for disposal under their discharge permit. And then the second settlement is with Chris Matisse, who owns a site that was formerly owned by Semco Twist Drill and Tool Company that manufactured drill bits and other cutting tools using solvents. And Mr. Matisse failed to submit a site work plan to evaluate impacts from the site to indoor air, soil, and groundwater by the required date. And then moving to table two, which includes one issued expedited payment program letter to resolve mandatory minimum penalties for effluent limit violations at San Luis Obispo's wastewater. Issued schedule order for San Benito Foods tomato processing facility. And then table four includes issued notices of violation, which includes, I just wanted to highlight 235 NOVs that the Irrigated Lands Program prepared for failure to submit groundwater sampling data required by the previous agricultural order. And the executive officer discussed these in more detail during his report yesterday. And then table five includes one issued notice of noncompliance for a construction site in Goleta that failed to get enrolled under the stormwater general permit. And table six includes a summation of recent violations that are pending further review by staff. And I'm going to transition to the second part of this item and just provide a brief update on the two supplemental environmental projects that are currently in progress. The first SEP is funded through a settlement with Monterey Mushrooms for unauthorized discharges to Elkhorn Slough. And this SEP is administered by the Community Water Center to provide treatment where water enters a house for well water contaminated with 123 trichloropropane, TCP, in northern Monterey County. And these residents are also receiving bottled water for drinking water and cooking to address concurrent nitrate contamination, but these residents are not protected from exposure to 123 TCP due to inhalation and dermal exposure from showering and other household uses. And cost-effective treatment methods for 123 TCP have not been widely studied or implemented. This project has faced challenges finding candidate sites and higher than anticipated system costs. We're working with the Community Water Center to navigate these challenges to ensure the maximum number of systems installations with the settlement funds. And the project team has installed three treatment systems, and all those systems are treating 123 TCP to below the detection limit. And the team is currently installing the remaining six treatment systems. And once all nine systems are in, 11 households will have treatment serving 47 people. And the project team plans to conduct system operation and maintenance through June of 2023 and share lessons learned with stakeholders. And then the second step that's currently in progress is funded through a settlement with Monterey One Water for unauthorized discharges of untreated wastewater to the ocean. And most of the penalty is funding a SEP to repair and replace defective sewer private sewer laterals within disadvantaged and severely disadvantaged communities in the Castroville Community Services District service area. And this project is intended to improve the sanitary sewer system integrity to prevent overflows and protect groundwater and public health. So far, Monterey One Water has provided bilingual outreach to property owners, notifying them of this work, and a contractor is currently conducting video investigations. And that concludes my summary of the enforcement report.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Let's see, I think it's table four in attachment one is notice of violations issued. I see a handful of cannabis operators, primarily in Monterey County, failure to obtain regulatory coverage. I'm just curious, where are we in, let me first say, the cannabis permit program got off to a kind of a rough start, and we saw some efforts by staff to do workshops and do some outreach to assist growers who had no experience with water board regulatory permitting to come on board. And I see that just a small number here. So what would you say, those workshops were helpful? Did you see a wave of people enrolling, or is this just simply going in stages where you're starting to track now and do the follow-up on those that are still failing to enroll in the program?
Thank you, Dr. Hunter, for the good question. So I actually have Arwen Wyatt Meyer, who is the program manager for the cannabis program, and I'm going to have her help provide an answer to that question.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Arwen Wyatt Meyer, senior engineer and program manager for the cannabis and NPDES programs. So the notice of violations that you see in this table were in response to law enforcement investigations of illegal unenrolled sites. These particular sites, as typically happens when law enforcement is the lead agency, they were eradicated. So there's no more cannabis, they're not going to enroll with us. We still issue these letters because, one, they should have obtained regulatory coverage with us previously. And two, it's part of our notification process for ensuring that the landowners, operators, everybody involved is fully aware of the requirement to obtain coverage in the future if they want to grow cannabis anywhere else. So that's what all of those notice of violation letters are about. In terms of our outreach, it's been a while since we did kind of an enrollment related outreach. We've been focusing more on our outreach has been focused more on technical reporting. So trying to help our enrolled people understand what they need to do, what they need to submit. And then we do have plans to continue to coordinate with other agencies, law enforcement, and the State Water Board to identify additional sites that likely have cannabis and are unenrolled with us, and we will be reaching out to them. The enforcement, kind of law enforcement inspection season for cannabis is upon us. It has begun. So we expect to be invited on law enforcement related inspections coming up. And then we'll also in tandem be trying to identify sites that law enforcement doesn't have time to inspect because they can't go to every site, and we'll be sending enrollment directives to those sites as well.
Thank you. And I'm glad you additional time to answer the question, talk about how the coordination works with law enforcement. Because I was curious about who takes the lead role, and I'm guessing it's law enforcement when they are driving that process. So, but it can also come from our end. So if we were to be able to locate an entity not enrolled but clearly operating in a grower mode, we would contact law enforcement in that case and coordinate with them, or do we just move through our own process first?
So both are options. We cannot, as water board staff, go to these unenrolled illegal grow sites on our own. We would have to have law enforcement with us. So we might, if we really want to inspect the site because we suspect there might be significant water quality issues at the site, we would reach out to law enforcement, see if they have the time and resources to accompany us. If they can, then that's great. We all go out together. If not, then we can still do our kind of administrative process where we would at least tell them of the requirement to enroll and then proceed from there. And we would certainly involve law enforcement, make sure they're aware of what's going on either way.
I appreciate that update.
Thank you. Vice Chair Wolf.
Yeah, thank you. Just first as a quick follow-up on Dr. Hunter's question. You know, the Regional Water Quality Control Board does not have trespassing rights on properties and therefore always have to work hand in hand with other agencies who do have trespassing rights, such as Fish and Wildlife, such as the Sheriff, and such as NOAA. So I'd like to go back quickly to the Community Water Center. In 1 year, 2023, the funding will have expired for the water treatment systems currently installed with TCP 123. As stated earlier, TCP 123 has inhalation, dermal, and ingestion harm, being a toxic pollutant. So any idea what's next then in a year? Because, you know, saying, okay, we're done, we walk away from this is probably not a good happy ending for, you know, this project that had some significant funding to try to develop a pilot project. So do we have any comments on that?
Yes, thanks, Chair, Vice Chair Wolf, for this good question. So we too are very vested in supporting these households and Community Water Center and trying to find solutions to support funding, keeping these systems in for the long term for those households that are not able to fund the O&M operation and maintenance to maintain those systems. So two things. One is Community Water Center is in discussions with State Board's Division of Financial Assistance to look for potential funding. And it sounds like potentially through the SAFER program, there might be an opportunity for either the Community Water Center or another technical assistance provider to provide point of entry support for this project. So Community Water Center is definitely working on that. But I also wanted to point out that 6 of the 9 systems are actually part of areas that are slated for potential long-term solutions, consolidation projects. And Community Water Center, during a recent discussion I had with them, estimated, it depends on the area, but a range of 3 to 8 years where those 6 systems might be part of a long-term solution.
All right, so there's a hope in sight. Thank you very much for that clarification.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. Harlan.
I had a question about the Monterey One Water Order. And could you tell me what happened at the treatment plant that they had 3 discharges? Were they at the same time or were they different days and weeks? Or what exactly happened? What caused that?
So this is based on my memory, but thank you, Board Member Harlan, for the question. So there was a failure at a lift station in Pacific Grove that is managed by Monterey One Water. It's part of Monterey One's water's collection system, an electrical failure which caused the lift station to fail, and a discharge of untreated raw sewage went to the Pacific Ocean in that area. And then there was also another spill that happened related to a failure at Monterey One Water's wastewater treatment plant that caused a bypass of the facility and an inability for the facility to treat all of their flows coming in. I would need to go verify if there was a third. That's based on my recollection. If you give me a moment, I can can look it up.
Oh, that's okay. Okay. You can get back to me later about that.
Okay.
I can answer that. There was a third smaller spill, but the main one, the main spill that occurred was approximately 3 million gallons that went into the ocean, and that's the bulk of the enforcement project. But when we have violations and we do a settlement, we usually combine all of the different spills into one. So there were two smaller ones and one large one.
Thank you. And I know Pacific Grove had problems years ago with sewage overflow spills, and have they upgraded their equipment so that it's in better shape now?
They're very aware of the issues in the Pacific Grove area, and they're working towards that. I don't have the details currently what the status is, but the electrical failure was something that was a little bit not infrastructure related, but more human error related. And the lift station in the Pacific Grove area is very close to the ocean. And so they're having some, they need to move it basically, but I'm not sure what status is of that, but we can follow up on that. But yes, the previous spill, I forget what year it was in Pacific Grove, and it's similar, just aging infrastructure and spills when there's high volumes happening occur there in that area.
Thank you.
While you're on, Ms. Tryon, and related to the question that Ms. Harlan just asked, are you aware of Coastal Commission's pursuing relocation or request of Pacific Grove to move their facility?
I am not, so I will have to follow up with Monterey One Water to see what the status is of them resolving this issue.
Thank you. Yeah, of course, as we move forward with lots of sea level rise analyses required and certainly climate change on the horizon, I think that we decided we were having or hopefully going to be dialoguing with Coastal Commission on a more regular basis.
Thank you, Chair Gray. I just want to point out that, you know, what we're talking about here is not a wastewater facility itself, but a potentially large number of pump stations along the coast in some of our urbanized areas, you know, not the least of which a good example would be Pacific Grove and other portions of Monterey and Carmel. Those are certainly something that's on our radar, and I believe Coastal Commission's as well. It would take a considerable effort to redesign and rebuild urban area wastewater collection systems. And I think most people will be aware of that. In most cases, I think what we might be looking at is armoring those systems and adding additional controls to help address potential sea level rise inundation. I know Monterey One Water in particular, this question came up when we actually had the enforcement item brought before the board. And Paul Sciuto indicated that as part of their long-term planning, they were working on ways to address the collection system and those pump stations along the coast in particular.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate the clarification there. Okay, I have a question related to attachment number one. And just wanted to see what the status of the relationship is with California Men's Colony on their ACL. Is it still sort of the same relationship and situation?
I would actually prefer not to discuss that since it's a active enforcement case.
Thank you. Okay. So I have nothing else at this time. Anything else? Any public comment, Ms. Wilson?
Just a moment, let me check. Nope, nothing new.
Okay. So with that, we've come to the end of our agenda for the day. Before we adjourn, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Yu.
sorry. The board is actually going to be going into closed session, and we're going to be discussing litigation that is pending. This is under the authorization of Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision E. The board will be discussing litigation that's identified on the agenda as item 15.5, two petitions that have been filed with the State Water Board for review of the 2021 Agricultural Waste Discharges Order. There's nothing that we'll be reporting out at the end of the closed session, so this webcast will be ending at this time. However, the board will be reconvening in this particular room to close out the meeting at that point in time.
Thank you, Ms. Yu. So we are closing the meeting at this moment. Thank you. 12:27.